Today at Reader's Corner, we hear from Jonathan Slatt, the author of Owls of the Eastern Ice. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. When he was just a fledgling bird watcher, Jonathan Slatt had a chance encounter with one of the most mysterious birds on Earth. Bigger than any owl he knew, it looked like a small bear with decorative feathers. He snapped a quick photo and shared it with experts who identified the Blakiston's fish owl. Soon he was a lifelong journeyist, searching for this enormous, enigmatic creature in the lush, remote forests of eastern Russia. Since they are also endangered, Slatt and his devoted team aimed to craft a conservation plan to help ensure the species' survival. Jonathan Slatt is the Russia and Northeast Asia Coordinator for the Wildlife Conservation Society, where he manages research projects on endangered species and coordinates avian conservation activities from the Arctic to the tropics. His work has been featured by the New York Times, The Guardian, BBC World Service, NPR, Smithsonian Magazine, Scientific American, and Audubon Magazine, among others. Jonathan Slatt, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hi, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Jonathan, first of all, congratulations on your book. It's been met with outstanding reviews. You were long listed for the National Book Award. I've got to ask you, did you have any idea when you sent this thing into the publisher that it was going to wind up like this?
No, I mean, no, of course not. I mean, I wasn't even sure that I could find a publisher, to be honest. And then really, I thought that this book might be a hit with, you know, the owl nerds and the Russophiles. You know, I didn't think it would meet this level of national interest. And the long list for National Book Award is just, you know, a remarkable honor.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the owl nerds. Tell us what this owl looks like and how it might differ from the occasional owl we might see here in America. I say occasional because, of course, we usually see them at night. And I guess I have three categories for you. How noisy is the owl compared to eagle versus the owl? When I looked at one of your fantastic photos in the middle of the book, I thought more of an eagle than an owl. And then finally, what it hunts.
Yeah, as far as your description goes, I mean, these owls are improbably large. It's as far as weight goes, it weighs about three times what a great horned owl weighs. And so getting into the range of a bald eagle, you know, they have, you know, 6 foot wingspans. They stand 2.5 feet tall. Like, they are just monsters. And so to see something this large trying to fight through, you know, the canopy of a riparian forest is just, you know, they're not necessarily graceful.
Yeah.
And their primary prey are aquatic. They mostly take salmonid fish, like, you know, salmon or trout. They also take frogs and eels and things like that. And I think that's, you know, so they lack some of the standard characteristics that people typically associate with owls. And that is things like silent flight and hypersensitive hearing. They're pretty loud when not only are they knocking over branches as they're flying through the canopy, but they're also, you know, their wings make noise, which is very atypical for most owl species.
Mm-hmm. And their countenance, I think you mentioned in the book, is different in the sense that most owls we think of have these kind of flat faces, this different countenance.
Yeah, absolutely. They lack the facial disc that many owls have. And, you know, the purpose of that disc, right, is to channel sound. It acts like a parabola to channel sound to their ear holes. So they can really pinpoint exactly where something is. And the fish owls, they have facial discs, but they're not nearly as defined as most owl species. And I think that's because, you know, they're hunting along these loud rivers. And I think they'd go crazy if they had hypersensitive hearing with all that water noise.
So when they go after these salmon, are they going after them the way an eagle goes after a fish in the water, or an osprey?
You know, with all of my observations of these birds hunting has been in winter, and they're hunting in very shallow water, you know, 10, 15 centimeters, so pretty shallow. And so everything I've seen is hunting in ambush, just sitting on the riverbank, waiting for something to swim by that's, you know, a fish that's a little bit exposed in the shallow water, then jumping in and grabbing it. There is evidence from Japan, where there are fewer than 200 of these birds, of a whole variety of different hunting techniques, fishing techniques, including, you know, kind of the full body dive that we would expect from an osprey.
Right. Amazing. So how'd you land on fish owls for your dissertation project at the University of Minnesota?
Well, you know, it's, I'd love for it to be this nice romantic reason, but it really boiled down to money and convenience. You know, I'd done a master's degree in that same area with working with songbirds, and it was really hard to fund that work. You know, no one wants to pay money to monitor forest birds in Russia. So I wanted to do, for my PhD, I wanted something that had real conservation impact, but was also easier to fund. So I didn't have to spend so much time writing grants. So that was one reason that I picked this large, charismatic, poorly studied bird. And another reason was I'd narrowed it down to the fish owl and the hooded crane, which is another one of these really kind of mysterious birds of the region. And I realized that the habitat of the hooded crane was far more torturous than the habitat of the fish owl. The cranes nest in these larch bogs that are exposed, they're hot, they're buggy. And honestly, I decided rather be up all night in winter chasing owls around the woods than, you know, fighting through a larch bog.
Now, were you in the Peace Corps? And if you were, is that where your command of Russian comes in? Because you obviously speak Russian throughout this book to your partners in Russia who are working with you.
Right. Yeah. I was in the Peace Corps for 3 years in that part of the world in Russia. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But I learned Russian earlier than that. My father was a U.S. diplomat and he was stationed in Moscow in the early 1990s.
Oh,
and
wow.
Because of that, I grew up always speaking different languages. So, you know, learning Russian was just, you know, another, you know, the new language to learn. So as soon as my family was stationed in Moscow, I started to study Russian. I was 15 or 16 years old.
Well, it's very clear from your description of the interaction between you and some of these Russians who we'll talk about in a minute that you're very fluent, and probably many of these folks might not even know that you weren't Russian except for one thing. And your photo on the back cover of the book shows you with a nice beard. And I think you point out that that's not a Russian thing where you were.
Yeah, I mean, the style has definitely changed now, where beards are now considered fashionable. But uh-huh. At the time of the book, so the mid-2000s, no one my age, mid-20s, had a beard. You just didn't. It was weird. So, all these caricatures of, Russians with their floppy hats and their big beards, that really wasn't something that you saw too much.
And they saw you coming along. It's like, oh, here comes the American.
Oh, yeah. And also even more so, just my down jacket, having, this huge, fluffy, bright, bright red jacket was, that was a dead giveaway that I wasn't from around there.
Right. So let's talk about where you find this owl in eastern Russia. Primorye, is that how you pronounce it?
Primorye.
Primorye, the province.
Right.
Tell us about that province and where it is and maybe something about the weather, because you had to endure the weather for so many years.
Yeah, it's a really interesting corner of the world. I mean, it's a temperate forest. It's at 45 degrees latitude, which is the same as where I am now in Minneapolis. But it has this odd combination of boreal species that come down from the north and subtropical species that come up from the south. So, that's why you have these species you associate with steamy jungles like tigers and leopards, sharing the same forest with boreal species like brown bears and lynx and wolves. So, and that's not just the mammals that are interesting. The vegetation all has this weird mix of temperate, boreal, and subtropical. So it's a remarkable place just to walk around, and the species assemblages are unique and fantastic. I mean, it is the only place in the world where you have brown bears and tigers living in the same forests. It's mostly mountainous, low rolling hills, somewhat reminiscent of the Appalachians, if you're familiar with those mountains, and then really beautiful coastline reminiscent of the Pacific Northwest.
You're listening to Jonathan Slatt. He's the author of Owls of the Eastern Ice, A Quest to Find and Save the World's Largest Owl. As far as the province is concerned and the people you met up with, I was fascinated to learn that under the old Soviet system, there was a hunting and trapping program that seemed to keep the locals in money, basically, keep them alive. That ended with the fall of the Soviet system. And I'm just wondering if you could help us understand what that local economy looks like today.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of these rural areas were definitely heavily supported by the state, a lot of subsidies going to these more remote areas. And so when I visited this one town, Agzu, in early 2006, you know, flew in there by helicopter because there were no roads leading there at the time. And a lot of the local economy had largely reverted to the barter system. You know, people didn't have money. They didn't need money. So, you know, someone would go out and, you know, trap some things and, you know, bring them into town and trade the meat or the furs to the store for other staples. And then the store would ship those things out on the next helicopter. So it was a really interesting, you know, kind of a step back in time when I was there in 06.
I have to pick up on that comment you made about flying in by helicopter. I think it was early in the book you mm-hmm. described this old Russian helicopter coming for you or whatever. And I thought, there is no way in the world I would get on that sucker. This guy must have lots of faith and quite a bit of courage in accepting the avian safety of Russia. Tell us about your experiences flying around Russia. Do you have any close calls?
Well, I do. You know, I think it's my faith is based on, you know, having lived there for 3 years in the Peace Corps and having, you know, spent half a year there as an undergraduate. It's one of these places where you kind of roll with it, because if you don't, you know, if you stop every time there's something potentially questionable, you're never going to get anywhere. I'd been on a number of those types of helicopters before. I trusted the crews to maintain them. So I, you know, I figured they're about as safe as you can get. And they also, you know, they don't fly during remotely inclement weather. If it's a little bit windy, they don't fly. If it's foggy, they don't fly. So they're pretty safe about when they fly and when they don't.
So you didn't do this work by yourself, that's for sure. And you tell some great stories. I want to talk about your research partners in a moment. But before we do that, I'd like you to help our listeners understand the Russian household. I was fascinated by the people you met in these towns and the way they lived. I certainly had it confirmed that vodka is still the drink of choice in Russia, apparently. There's no doubt about that. So give us a peek inside the Russian household you visited over these years.
Sure. Yeah. So this place, it is fairly remote. So, you know, Primorye has about 2 million people living in the province. Half of that number is just in Vladivostok. And then most of the remainder are in smaller cities closer to Vladivostok. And then most of the villages are just a couple thousand, maybe a couple hundred people. And these are folks who are accustomed to being self-reliant. You know, this one town I visit a lot in the book called Amgu. I forget what year, but it was a bad flood year, and something like 15 bridges had been knocked out between Ternay, one of the closer towns, and Amgu. And it was like a month that there was no road access to Amgu. And the people, it didn't really bother them. You know, sure, there were certain things that they didn't have in the one of the, you know, three stores that they have in Amgu. People kept fishing in the ocean for their fish. They kept hunting the deer and the boar in the woods for their meat. They had cows to milk and to make cheese. So, I mean, they're hardy individuals living in these like small wooden homes with wood burning stoves. And sometimes they have wells to get their water. So it's, you know, they're hard living people.
Outhouses, I assume?
Yes, absolutely. There's very little. I mean, things have changed a little bit today, but yes, for the, most places, I would still say have outhouses rather than internal plumbing.
Mm-hmm. By the way, we should probably give some time here for you to tell us how long you were at this. I mean, from the time you first decided the fish aisle is my dissertation and I'm going to Russia to do it until today, let's say. How many years has that been that you've been engaged in this effort?
Yeah, I want to say March 2006 was my first time, you know, stepping off of a plane in Russia saying, okay, I'm now going to do fish aisles. And you know, the degree was about 5 years, which is, I think, normal-ish for a PhD degree. Mm-hmm. And I still do the work now. I'm still working with the same people, the Sergeys, you know, Sergey Avdyuk and Sergey Surmich that I mentioned in the book. Every year we're doing something with fish owls.
And that's where I was going next with my question is, tell us about Sergey. And obviously they're your very good friends these days.
Yeah. And, you know, I do want to make it clear, and I think I try to do this in the book, is, you know, show that it is, you know, it's not me doing this work. It's us doing the work.
And yeah, you did.
Had I stepped off that plane in 06, you know, there's no way I would have been able to do any of this without their knowledge of fish owls. The Sergeys, Surmich and Avdyuk, had been looking for fish owls for about a decade before I got involved. Surmich is an ornithologist with the Russian Academy of Sciences. And Avdyuk is his brother-in-law, who was an engineer in the Soviet times. And then, you know, that all collapsed and just started spending more and more time in the woods and has become just a incredible woodsman who's really capable of understanding the landscape and animals. And he kind of, Avdyuk leads Surmich's crews anytime there's some bird work or other work to be done in the woods.
And when it comes to understanding the landscape, one of the things that is really somewhat of a thrilling series of episodes in your book is crossing these rivers. And this is not like crossing a peaceful river that's 4 inches deep. Tell us about that experience. These guys, of course, know these rivers well, and it sounds like you were able to follow their lead in some cases in avoiding getting swept away.
Right. And it's similar to the helicopter where I was just following the lead of people who knew what they were doing. And I absolutely, you know, trusted and, you know, do trust Sergey Avdyuk. But yeah, so even Russians who aren't familiar with these rocky coastal rivers. So the mountain range, the central ridge of the range is at most 50 kilometers from the coast. So the rivers that flow into the Sea of Japan are, you know, they're relatively short. They're relatively shallow. The water might only be knee deep in places, but it's such a fast current that it can really take you down. And so we ran the gambit throughout the book with trying to use snowmobiles on the melting ice, trying to cross a flooded river in a truck at times we're bouncing, you know, on the bottom of the river, meaning that we're not in control. And the river mouth was really just, half a kilometer away. So we weren't that far from being washed out to the ocean, really. So yeah, just, you know, again, I just tried to follow Sergey's lead, and we made it out every time.
So what were your research goals in this effort that starts in 2006, as far as fish owls are concerned?
Yeah, so fish owls are an endangered species, and by Russian law, the animals and their habitat cannot be harmed. But the owls had been so poorly studied and so poorly known that there was no conservation plan. So there was nothing for industry to refer to, for example. And just within the past 20 years, there's been a real explosion of resource extraction in what was thought to be prime fish owl habitat. So the goal of this project, of my PhD and of the work I've done with fish owls since then, was to find some owls, catch them, put transmitters on them to monitor where they're going, to better understand what parts of the landscape are important for them, to then make recommendations for a conservation plan that we could share with loggers, for example, about minimizing the harm of logging on fish owls.
Okay, next question. How do you catch a fish owl?
Well, and that was a big part of the book, because, you know, we didn't know.
Right.
No one really knew how to do it. And different raptors are susceptible to different types of traps. Like something that works for one species may or may not work for another. So I went, you know, I did a bunch of reading on different capture techniques. I talked to some U.S. raptor capture specialists and went over there with a couple different things in my toolbox. And we tried a number of things over the course of the first season before we actually found something that worked. And it turned out the key for us was using live fish as lures. Well, first of all, you know, fish owls are non-migratory. So they're staying in these same places year round, where it gets to, you know, mid minus 30s on a regular basis in winter. And most water freezes when it gets that cold. But there are few patches along these rivers that remain unfrozen reliably year in and year out. And some of that is due to seeping radon gas that warms the water a little bit. So that's where the fish owls are hunting. So we put these little boxes, little mesh boxes, open top boxes in the rivers, caught some fish nearby, and used that as a lure to bring the owls in.
Now, do I understand that you used the fish for sure, but there was a reference to a pigeon in your book. I think there was a point where these owls are predators. So if it's alive and moving, they'll probably go after it. And you used some pigeons. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. One season we had, one of the field assistants was an experienced falconer, and his preferred capture method was something called a doe gaza, which uses something live as bait, and he used a pigeon, and we were able to catch one fish owl that way, and the pigeon was unharmed.
Tell us about the reproduction of the fish owl. What did you learn about how they procreate?
Yeah, so I think one of the reasons they're endangered is that they reproduce very slowly. The birds in Russia tend to breed only every other year. So they're not breeding every year, and they tend to produce only one chick, the fledge one chick from that effort. And then it takes that bird about 3 years to reach sexual maturity. So it can take a really long time just to add one more bird into the breeding population. So if, you know, a bird drowns in a salmon net or gets hit by a car or something, it's a number of years before that bird can be replaced and start adding to the population again.
You're listening to Jonathan Slatt. He's the author of Owls of the Eastern Ice, A Quest to Find and Save the World's Largest Owl. How long does a fish owl live?
Well, there are records from Japan of nearly 30 years in the wild. So quite a long time. Mm-hmm. And they don't really have natural predators. They're so large that, you know, as long as, you know, we're not hitting them with our cars or they're not drowning in our nets, that, you know, they should live long lives.
Speaking of Japan, the fish owl is, as you say, across the Sea of Japan in that country. But the Japanese use a very different method to guarantee the survival of the fish owl. Maybe you can explain that.
Yeah, so in Japan, after the Second World War, there was a lot of interest in the natural resources of Hokkaido, the northern island of that country where there are fish owls. And so, you know, starting in the 50s, they started cutting down these big trees and damming rivers. As it turned out, they were really limiting the resources that these owls need. I mean, you know, salmon could no longer run up the rivers because the rivers were dammed almost at the mouth. And there weren't these large trees that they need to nest in anymore. And so the population almost went extinct there. There were fewer than 100, I believe, in about 1980. And now that population has more than doubled as a result of pretty significant investment and effort by the Japanese government and biologists. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 70% of the birds currently in Japan are either artificially fed, so they stock ponds to feed them, or they breed in nest boxes that the government and researchers erect.
Is any of those practices likely to be copied by the Russians?
Yes, we started to. In 2015, there's one fish owl territory that we've been monitoring since 2006. The resident pair there, it's the same birds, the same two birds. We'd watch them go through four different nest trees that were either felled in storms or decayed too much to be suitable breeding spaces anymore. So we put a nest box up there, taking a cue from what our colleagues in Japan were doing. And, you know, we put a camera up in the tree just to see if the owls would find it and what they would do if they did find it. And it took them like 8 days. It was really fast that they found this plastic barrel that we cut a hole in the side of and strapped it to a tree. And they've now, I mean, that pair's bred in that box three times now. So they've produced three chicks in the last 5 years.
Yeah. So you mentioned something about an owl, one of your fish owls getting knocked off by a car. There's a portion of your book toward the end when you talk about the threats to the fish owl being salmon overfishing and roads. How is life changing in this province that creates a real challenge for those of you trying to save the fish owl.
Yes, I mean, roads are the real issue. That's kind of the source of all the problems for fish owls, and I think for biodiversity in general in the region. You know, there aren't that many people that live in the northern county, which is where I do all my work with fish owls. There's 10,000 people there, but there's 4,000 kilometers of road. You know, they're all mostly logging roads. And so that just provides access to anyone who can drive from anywhere to these places. And you know, people drive these roads at night and they spotlight, they poach deer, boar, they'll shoot tigers. They drive in, they'll set these nets for to poach salmon, or even just a family will go in and have a campfire, and then the campfire, some of these fires can get out of control. And it's just a huge threat. And since fish owls are so reliant on river valleys specifically, they almost never leave a river valley. That's where all the roads are. And so there's a real conflict between humans and fish owls there.
And I suppose that as Russians find their way into the province, overfishing becomes a problem as well. And that's, of course, competing with the fish owl.
Yes. And that's, when fish owls, even though they're breeding only every other year, they typically lay two eggs and fledge just the one chick. And, my suspicion is that it's overfishing that's led to, I think, likely two chicks is what they normally do, they normally raise. And the lack of availability of fish, of prey, is what's reducing their reproductive output.
I mentioned in the intro that you have become affiliated with the Wet Wildlife Conservation Society, and I believe toward the end of your book, you talk about how your focus has turned, in part anyway, to tigers and leopards. Could you tell us about the challenge that in that part of Russia, as far as tigers and leopards are concerned, is it the Amur tiger?
Right. Yeah. So it's a Amur tiger. It's the same thing as the Siberian tiger, but there are technically no tigers in Siberia, which is an administrative region in the middle of the country. And so tigers live in the Amur River basin in the Russian Far East, which is why Amur is better. So I've been an employee of the Wildlife Conservation Society since I got my degree in 2011. And I've been collaborating with those guys since about 2000 over there. So I've been really affiliated with WCS for a while. But once I got my degree, there wasn't really a job for fish owl specialist in the region. And tigers and leopards, these big charismatic mammals, they tend to suck a lot of the air out of the conservation room. There's a lot of focus on those animals. And so the job I was able to get was essentially writing grants to fund the tiger and the leopard work that my organization does in Russia, while still finding time to do work with fish owls.
So what's the challenge as far as the tiger or the leopard is concerned? Are they endangered? I mean, you have one piece of your book where you describe a real grisly scene where a tiger caught up with a guy fishing, I believe, and he didn't have a very good return on that investment.
Yeah, well, that tigers are endangered. The leopards are critically endangered, and the tiger in that episode was sick with canine distemper. But a lot of the issues are the same. Tigers. Almost every field season when I'm out looking for fish owls in winter, we're seeing tiger tracks. They walk along a frozen river just like we do, because it's easier than walking through the tangles of a floodplain. So, fish owl conservation is essentially tiger conservation. It's all biodiversity preservation in the region.
I understand that the tiger's plight even attracted the interest of Hollywood recently.
Yeah, tigers. Tigers are popular. People can raise a lot of money for them. And I think it's, generally speaking, I think it's a good strategy, because, the tigers in Russia, a male has a home range of, 1,200 square kilometers. So, if you're investing in tiger conservation and you're protecting that space in Russia, like you're protecting just about everything else.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't it Leonardo DiCaprio who came over there and did some kind of an event with Putin?
Yeah, there was a big tiger forum. I off the top of my head, I forget what year, but there was a tremendous amount of international celebrity interest. I mean, DiCaprio went, and Naomi Campbell, I believe, went or otherwise supported it.
So my last question, and we're out of time, is a more personal one, I guess, but you bring it up toward the end of your book. I guess it's like, what's the future hold for you and your family? You have a wife and two kids, and your work is in Russia. And I'm just curious, how's this work out?
Well, when I first started going over there for this work, I would go for 3 months at a time. And you know, I'd walk out in February, come back a few months later. And since my kids were born, that's been reduced significantly. And since my daughter was born, she's now four, I try not to go for just a few weeks at a time.
Yeah.
So while the Fishel work continues and you know the Sergeys are out there for weeks at a time doing this work, in a non-COVID year, I try to hook up for maybe a week just to kind of plug in, get my boots dirty, remember why I'm doing this work and why it's fun and why it's meaningful, and then come back. And I travel throughout Asia now too. I'm doing a lot of migratory bird work, as you mentioned in the intro. So mm-hmm. going from the Arctic, you know, in Alaska and the Russian Arctic down to, you know, Cambodia and Myanmar, working on some of these migratory bird issues. And I can sneak away for shorter periods of time if I'm doing work like that.
Well, congratulations again on your career, first of all, and thanks for taking the time to sit down and write the book so the rest of us have some idea of what's going on in the rest of the world. The book is The Owls of the Eastern Ice, A Quest to Find and Save the World's Largest Owl. The author is Jonathan Slatt, who has joined us today. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob. This was fun.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.